Okay, we're starting a session on 1 Peter, and that will follow straight on to a discussion of 2 Peter. But to understand many of the passages in 1 Peter, it's important to know why and when it was written. And although I could spend a long time on a detailed introduction, as this is only an overview, I'll make it as concise as I can, but even this short introduction should help us to get the context of the letter before we look at the text itself. And as you'll see, that becomes very important. So a few questions. The first is that we need to ask who, in fact, actually wrote the letter, because, believe it or not, some scholars doubt that it was, in fact, Peter, the apostle of Jesus. However, the situation described in the letter fits so well with the events happening in Peter's lifetime. And there's no way we can get around the fact that the author actually says he is, quote, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, unquote, and that he was, quote, a witness of Christ's suffering, unquote. That's chapter 5 and verse 1. So if the letter was not written by Peter, then these statements are simply untrue and the whole thing is a fabrication. In addition, the author is somebody who knew the Old Testament well. He quotes Isaiah and the Psalms frequently. And while he does not directly quote from the Gospels, he frequently uses words and phrases which are echoes of the teaching that they contain. And this, of course, would fit Peter like a glove, as, of course, he heard Jesus' teaching firsthand for over 3 years. There are also similarities, and this is interesting, in the letter of Peter with Peter's speeches in the Acts of the Apostles. And in fact, it would be easy to draw up a column of phrases in 1 Peter and then match them against a column of phrases from Peter's speeches in the book of Acts, which again is a hint that Peter really was the author of this letter. Finally, and this should be convincingly, as early as the beginning of the second century, we have other leaders in the church who also hold the view that the Apostle Peter himself was indeed the author of the letter. So while liberal scholars continue to debate the authorship of the epistle, they will use different arguments about style and the vocabulary, etc., there's no convincing reason to conclude that it was not, in fact, written by the Apostle Peter himself. Now, second, by way of introduction, to interpret it accurately, we need to try and discover where it was actually written from. In 1 Peter 5:13, he sends his greetings from, quote, she who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, unquote. But it seems very unlikely that this is a reference to a local church in the ancient city of Babylon. And so it's hard to believe that Peter was actually writing from that city itself, although some of the apostles and many of the early evangelists went to the east, reaching as far as Persia, India, Afghanistan, and even China by a very early date. Not, of course, the apostles, but many of the early evangelists in the second century BC. However, as far as Peter is concerned, although the city of Babylon was still inhabited when Peter wrote this letter. It was a virtual ruin, and therefore it would make it a very unlikely location for somebody like Peter, who needed a more central location to continue to oversight the churches for which he was responsible. So it's very unlikely that Peter is actually in ancient Babylon writing this letter. However, most scholars agree that Babylon was a code name for Rome. And we find Babylon often being used this way in both Jewish literature and, of course, the book of Revelation. In addition, persecution had broken out in Rome, and it would be appropriate for Peter, if he's writing from Rome, to send advance warning of the spreading Roman persecution to the believers in Asia Minor, which was the destination of the letter, as we'll see in a moment, and which was also a stronghold of imperial emperor worship. By the way, we should remember that prior to this, the church was primarily persecuted by the Jews. The persecution of the Romans was just beginning to take place towards the end of Peter's life. And he was, of course, executed by the Romans, but the major persecutions came somewhat later. All this points to the fact that Peter was writing from Rome, and this itself is supported even by such early writers as Tertullian and the early historian Eusebius. Thirdly, we need to ask, do we actually know who Peter was writing to? Because in chapter 1, verse 1, Peter addresses his letter to, quote, God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. The provinces described here were, as I've said, in Asia Minor or modern Turkey, north of the Taurus Mountains. And if you traveled in this region, you know that these mountains are very high indeed. I've traveled several times over those mountains, but the most memorable occasion was when we went through them by train and lost count of the number of tunnels simply because there were so many as we wound our way through the mountains. It's quite a trip. So initially, what probably happened is that a messenger took the letter to the main churches in the area, where it would then have been copied for distribution to the smaller churches in the surrounding regions. And this was probably true of some of Paul's letters, like Colossians. Now, just to mention that James uses a similar greeting to Peter and addresses his epistle to, quote, the 12 tribes in the diaspora, the dispersion. However, from the contents of the letter or the epistle of James, he's obviously writing to Jewish believers. But much like the book of Hebrews, which was also written to Jewish believers, that's why it's called the book to the Hebrews, James was seen by the early church as a book, although written to Hebrew believers, also applied to Gentile believers. And so it became one of the New Testament documents. However, Peter's letter, unlike James, is obviously aimed at a mixed gathering of Jewish and Gentile believers. So while he uses this very Jewish sounding phrase of people being in dispersion, what, as I've said, we call the diaspora. In his opening phrase, to the elect, to God's elect, scattered or dispersed throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, so on. He probably means this metaphorically, as we'll see in chapter 1 in a minute, as many of the other comments he makes will be more relevant to Gentiles rather than Jewish readers, which makes us think that he is using this phrase, unlike James, who was writing to Jews, although believing Jews, although it applied to believing Gentiles, probably Peter is using that phrase metaphorically. And as I say, many of the other comments he makes would be more relevant to Gentile rather than exclusively a Jewish audience. For instance, in 1:18, he speaks of the empty way of life handed down to you from our forefathers, which is a phrase he would never have used in describing Jews. He wouldn't have said that you had an empty way of life handed down from your forefathers. No way. And again in 2:10 he writes, once you are not a people, but now you are the people of God, which again is clearly a reference to Gentile believers. Then again in 4:3 he writes, you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans, that is Gentiles, choose to do. So obviously there were plenty of Gentiles in these churches, even though Peter addresses them as the 12 tribes scattered among the nations. Now, it seems that Peter wants to make a point that believers in Jesus are now the new Israel, the new covenant people of God, not in the sense of replacing Israel after the flesh, but in the sense that together with the believing Jews, they now make up the new covenant people of God, or what Paul calls the one new man, in which there's neither Jew nor Gentile, male nor free, bond, male nor female, bond or free. Praise the Lord, that one new man, what was called in the ancient world the third race. Now, the fourth question we need to ask is, can we put an approximate date on the letter? These questions might seem rather obscure, but they do affect how we interpret some of the contents of this epistle. And as I mentioned, while it was not yet extensive, Roman persecution had initially broken out, and very violently so in the reign of Nero, who was Caesar from about 54 to 68, 54 to 68 AD. And since Peter makes no reference to Paul's martyrdom, which we think took place about 64 AD, this would indicate that the letter was probably written before this. So if we date it somewhere between 63 and 64 AD, we probably won't be very far off. Now, a fire had devastated Rome in 64 AD, but strangely, some would say, it did not damage the property, a kind of the estates, the extensive property of Nero and his friends. And many, as you've probably heard, in fact, believed it was started by Nero himself. Therefore, Nero needed a scapegoat to divert suspicion away from himself, and the sect of Judaism called Christianity was a convenient place to lay the blame. The church did not have the legal protection that was given to the Jews, and therefore they were an easy target for the forces of Nero and the empire. And it's well known that the Romans viewed Christians as antisocial for several reasons. So in other words, they would have been unpopular with a segment of Rome because they were regarded already as antisocial. They wouldn't participate in the civic celebrations that honored the Greco-Roman pantheon of gods. Strangely enough, they were called atheists as they rejected these pagan gods. And in addition, they were called cannibals, as it was said that they ate flesh and blood at the Lord's table. And they were regarded as practicing incest, although I'm not sure how seriously we should take this charge. But the word was on the street simply because they would commonly make statements like, "I love you, brother," or "I love you, sister," especially when they would gather for the common meal that was called the love feast. And according to the early 2nd century historian Tacitus, who himself was no friend of Christians, Nero burned Christians alive as torches. He poured tar over them and burned them alive to light his gardens at night. And he killed other Christians by feeding them to wild animals to entertain the crowds in the Colosseum, and eventually ended up murdering thousands of Christians in Rome. So, to continue, it's probable against this background that Peter writes to the believers in Asia Minor, warning them of the coming storm. And why we bother with this background, with all these details, as I've said, is that knowing it helps us to understand the text as it fills in the gaps for those of us who are reading the epistle nearly 2,000 years later. But before we get into the text of chapter 1, it might be helpful to mention some of the distinctives in the book. I've listed just 7, but there are, of course, many more that could be found. So let me give you just 7. Number 1, suffering is mentioned 16 times. Number 2, glory is mentioned also 16 times. And some have said 1 Peter is a book about sufferings and glory. However, there are other distinctives. Thirdly, grace, or synonyms for grace. Well, grace is used, the word grace, charis, is used 9 times, plus many synonyms for grace are also used. Then fourthly, salvation or deliverance, the word sozo, is mentioned 5 times, again with the addition of many synonyms. Fifthly, humility is mentioned several times. We read in 5:5, quote, "All of you clothe yourselves with humility towards one another." And of course, this is an echo of John 13:4, where Jesus clothed himself as a servant with a towel and washed his disciples' feet. Number 6, shepherding is mentioned. In chapter 5, verse 2, we read, "Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care." And again, this is an echo of the passage at the end of John's Gospel, where you'll remember Peter had denied the Lord 3 times, and then after the resurrection, he's told 3 times by the Lord to shepherd his sheep. And then, seventhly and finally, there are 34 imperative statements in the book. Not all of them, unfortunately, come out in our English translations, but it makes the book very striking. Okay, if we could read it in the Greek text, it would be very striking. And I'll only mention a few. I can't mention all 34, but these you know very well, and it will give you a feel of things. But in such a short book, to have 34 imperatives gives it a real punch. And perhaps Peter knows that his days are nearly over, and he has some holy impatience. In other words, he doesn't simply want to write a letter, but he repeatedly urges the church to act on these things, not to be hearers only, but to be doers of the word. Now, here's just, I don't know how many I've listed, 7 or 8 imperatives, but I'll kind of speak them in the kind of imperative voice, if you like. And so he'll say, be sober. He'll say, be holy. He'll say, love one another. He'll say, long for the spiritual milk of the word. He'll go on, honor all men, even slaves. He'll say, fear God. He'll also say, honor the king. We may not obey Caesar. The apostles, you remember, said we have to obey God, not man, when they were told to stop preaching. So we may not obey him at times, but we still have to honor him. Then he'll say, arm yourselves. Arm yourselves. We'll come to, of course, all these texts as we move through the book. He'll say, be of sound mind. And you can hear it almost echoing as Peter makes these exhortations. He'll say, rejoice. Even though he knows his days are short, he'll say, rejoice. Much like Paul, when he was in prison, would say, rejoice. And again I say, rejoice. It's a similar emphatic imperative statement. Then he'll say, tend, shepherd the flock of God, and so on. We could mention many others. Of course, the most famous, resist the devil. And I'll mention others, as I say, as we go through the book, but these are a few to help us catch the tone of urgency, the kind of the bite behind Peter's use of the language. And so perhaps that's enough by way of introduction. And so we'll push right on into chapter 1.